At San Fernando, a sugar mill town in Pampanga province, the men were led to the train depot and assembled into groups of 100 alongside the narrow gauge tracks. The boxcars had baked all day in the sun, so that vaporous heat now rose off the sheeny metal in thick waves. The guards threw open the doors of the cars and gestured with their bayonets for the prisoners to climb inside. Tommy Thomas, the signal corpsman from Michigan, was the first in line, which he now realized was a bad place to be. When the guards brought the group to the San Fernando station, he had imagined that the prisoners would take a passenger train to wherever they were going, and he thought that if he could get on early enough, he might even find a seat. But once the string of tiny boxcars pulled up, he immediately saw his mistake. Somehow the guards expected 100 men to fit into each one of these rolling cells. When Thomas climbed up inside, the steady pressure of boarding bodies shoved him farther and farther away from the door, into the stifling dead air. The car was not ventilated. It felt like a kiln. The Japanese kept pushing and prodding, cramming more and more men inside. When it no longer seemed possible that any more could fit, the guards brought over an additional dozen or so, tamping them in with their rifle butts. Then, with a long, hideous screech, the rusty doors slid shut behind them. In the pitch darkness, the men could hear the guards fastening the door with a padlock. For a few minutes, they just stood there, blinking. A terrific stench rose up. The body smells of 100 men mingled in a close miasma. Most of them hadn't bathed in weeks. Their bodies were sour with encrusted sweat, gangrenous wounds, and the suppuration of tropical ulcers. Many of them had dysentery, and when they lost control, which was often, they had no option but to defecate where they stood. Soon the plywood floor was splattered with the blood mucus diarrhea that is the classic symptom of the disease. Thomas recalled, "A guy next to me said, 'Sorry, fellas, I can't help it. I can't stand it. I've got cramps.' He was almost crying, begging. Then he started shitting all over everybody." The train snapped forward, and the journey began. It was 120 degrees Fahrenheit inside, maybe hotter. "I thought we were going to be roasted alive," Thomas said. He felt like he was suffocating. The ceiling was too low for a man of 6'4". He was stooped in his corner, listening to the moans and sibilances, the scraping and buckling sounds of the old train car, the sound of people vomiting. Men collapsed, but had nowhere to fall. The living, the semi-conscious, and the soon-to-be-dead all stood together in a press of diseased flesh. Then the chills began. Thomas recognized instantly that he was having a malarial attack. His teeth clacked and rattled just like the train. His legs lost all strength, but the pressure of the other bodies kept him upright, pinned against the hot metal skin of the boxcar. He had cerebral malaria, the doctors would later ascertain, Plasmodium falciparum, the strain that made men go out of their heads, and if left untreated, often resulted in death. Shivering in the dark, hovering on the brink of awareness, Thomas seemed to lose track of time. Finally, after several hours, the train came to a halt, and the door squeaked open. "It was one of the sweetest sounds I've ever heard," Thomas said. Everyone tried to force his way out at once. Thomas pushed toward the daylight glare and leaped to the ground, sucking in the fresh air. Then he peered back into the gloom of the train car. There were about a dozen men, including the man who had been standing next to Thomas, who never came out. Sprawled in pools of excrement, they had stopped breathing. Abe Abraham and his friend Arthur Houtby emerged from their train into the bright heat of the day. "Where are we?" Houtby asked, disoriented and groggy.
"This is Coppice," Abraham said. He was vaguely familiar with the town. It was located some 40 miles north of San Fernando in the hot plains of Tarlac province. The barrio was coated in the fine, powdery dust of the dry season. Off to the west, the green Zambales Mountains, dominated by the seething Mount Pinatubo, clawed at a hazy sky. The Japanese led Abraham's group to an open space not far from the train station and detained the prisoners under the hot sun for more than an hour. The Americans came to call this form of torture the sun treatment. Abraham's guard made no effort to find a shady spot. For many prisoners, already cooked by the train ride, this sun lashing was the final blow. By the dozens, the men began to drop from heat exhaustion. Finally, they were grouped into columns again and pointed west. The march still wasn't finished. They stumbled out of Kapus on a narrow road lined with well-wishers. "Young girls threw us kisses," Abraham recalled, "and men working with their carabao in the fields turned and waved at us, some giving us the V for victory sign." The rural countryside was expansive, with faintly rolling hills covered in crisp, dry kogan grass. Containers of water had been left along the roadsides, but almost invariably the Japanese guards would kick them over before the prisoners could get a drink. After a few hours of marching, the column crept to the brow of a gentle hill. There, spread before them in the dusty heat, was a vast encampment of some 600 acres, surrounded by flimsy barbed wire. Scores of tattered nipa shacks slumbered in the glare, and thousands of people could be seen in the middle distance, moving about the pathways and thoroughfares. At the front gate, the Japanese had built a tall tower of wooden struts, from which they had festooned the rising sun, the flaming red asshole, as the Americans called it. Before the war, Camp O'Donnell had been a training facility for the Philippine Army. It was designed to accommodate no more than 9,000 people. By the time A.B. Abraham walked through the gates, however, O'Donnell's population had swelled to some 50,000 American and Filipino prisoners. Abraham's group was brought into the parade ground, where they were lined up and made to stand at attention. More sun treatment. Then guards undertook a comprehensive shakedown of every prisoner. One by one, the men were relieved of any valuables or contraband items that had not already been taken during the march. Then the camp commandant, Captain Yoshio Tsuniyoshi, stood on a box and, speaking through an interpreter, addressed the new arrivals. "You are the enemy," he began. "You will always be the enemy. 100 years from now, we will still be enemies." Captain Tsuniyoshi was a caricature of the bombastic prison warden. The Americans would call him Little Hitler. A short, bow-legged, mustachioed man, he wore baggy pants and riding boots with spurs. A large samurai sword dangled at his side. He had grave, penetrating eyes, a bald pate, a scar on his right cheek, and a mole on his bottom lip. "He was one of the ugliest mortals I have ever seen," one prisoner later wrote. "He breathed the very essence of hate." Tsuniyoshi's initiation speech lasted about a half hour. Satisfied that he had made his point, the captain stepped down from his box and swaggered off toward the headquarters shack that was perched on a knoll. Abraham and his group, having been officially welcomed to Camp O'Donnell, were led to their new barracks. Camp O'Donnell was a temporary holding station, a brief detainment in the Americans' long passage to other circles of hell. Most prisoners were kept there for only about 50 days. Yet O'Donnell was, for many, the most horrific experience of the war. It was the place where all the seeds of hunger and disease sown on Bataan came to full fruition. Americans had not seen deprivational grotesqueries on such a vast scale since the days of Andersonville, the infamous Civil War death camp for Union soldiers in Georgia. One prisoner later wrote, "Hell is only a state of mind. O'Donnell was a place." The sanitation was so appallingly bad, the stench so overwhelming, that the few Japanese who ventured inside the camp almost invariably wore surgical masks. The open slit trenches were breeding grounds for vermin, black flies, green blowflies, bluebottle flies, and intestinal parasites of every strain and stripe. The men were fed measly portions of whistleweed soup and lugao, a slop of watery rice that had a nauseating bluish tint and was often crunchy with maggots. The American side of camp was equipped with only two water spigots to serve the 9,000 POWs now imprisoned there. Each barracks, originally designed to accommodate 40 men, was crammed with more than 100. The double-decker sleeping bays were rank with the smell of humanity gone sour, Abraham recalled. At night, bedbugs by the millions crawled over us to steal the little flesh that still clung to our bones. The death toll at Camp O'Donnell was catastrophic. One out of every 10 prisoners who passed through O'Donnell perished there. In 2 months, more than 1,500 Americans and some 15,000 Filipinos were buried in mass unmarked graves. We constantly wondered who would be next, said Burt Bank. We couldn't keep up with our friends. The death toll was like a scoreboard that was constantly changing. With men dying at a rate of 30 or 40 a day, the bodies began to stack up like cordwood. The burial details couldn't dispose of the corpses fast enough. We worked like slaves digging graves, Abraham wrote. The days fell on us like a relentless hammer. We were wretched animals. Every day we walked among the dead, having no thoughts, no desires. There was no stopping the deaths. They went on and on like the waves of the ocean. The critically ill invariably ended up in a place called the Zero Ward, so named because patients consigned there were believed to have no chance of survival, and thus, in the grim triage of the camp, were offered no treatment. It couldn't be called a hospital, one prison doctor later testified. It was merely a place for men to go to die. By the hundreds, the diseased, half-naked prisoners were laid out on straw mats. Flies swarmed over their bodies. They were caked in their own night soil, and their pipe-stem arms and legs were covered with raw sores. To simplify the preparation of burial records, medics would scrawl the terminal patient's army serial number across his chest with a tincture of iodine or gentian violet. When someone passed away, his clothes were removed to be boiled and later recirculated among the living, and the body was stacked behind the Zero Ward to await burial. O'Donnell was less a prison than it was an incubatorium for disease. A study in what happens when thousands of starving, ill men are brought together in close proximity in the tropics. Antique diseases that had long since been conquered by modern medicine rose out of the latrines for an encore performance. The vectors for contagion were too numerous to count. Pathogens spread from man to insect to beast to shit to man again. Starvation and vitamin deficiency lowered the immunological threshold for everyone, so that hundreds succumbed to diseases that wouldn't ordinarily have killed them. Principally, the patients were dying of malaria, dysentery, pellagra, acute dehydration, beriberi, or various sordid combinations thereof. Yet in many cases the act of dying seemed to come by force of will. Every doctor saw it. A patient who was sick, but not necessarily terminal, would suddenly get an unmistakable look on his face, a million-mile stare, a crushing melancholy, as if to say, I cannot bear another moment. He would simply give up. Within hours, sometimes within minutes, he'd be dead. The prisoners called it give-up-itis. The doctors referred to it as inanition, the absence of spirit. Living was like holding onto a rope, said one medic. All you had to do was let go, and you were a goner. One person who quickly developed the characteristic look was Sergeant Arthur Houtby, A.B. Abraham's close friend. The hike out of Bataan had been too much for him. Look at Houtby, a friend said to Abraham one day. All he does is stare. He's in bad shape. I'm afraid he's not going to make it. A few days later, Abraham went to the ward to call on his friend. Houtby's face was coated in a quivering mass of flies. They buried him later that day. All through the early morning hours of Monday, January 29, 1945, the Rangers stepped warily through a broad field of kogan, the ubiquitous weed of the Philippines. Kogan grass afforded terrific cover, but it could also be a terrific nuisance. Each spike of coarse grass was as tall as a man and bore hundreds of silky hairs that made the Rangers' skin itch. Aside from its function as a thatching material, it was an agriculturally useless plant, inedible to humans and cattle alike. Still, it grew everywhere in the archipelago, cropping up like a sharp-eyed opportunist wherever old-growth forest was felled. The only effective way to get rid of Kogan was to burn it, and even now there were several brush fires smoldering somewhere in the distance, gauzing the night in an acrid haze. At daybreak, the long line of rangers and guerrillas stopped to rest in the barrio of Balin Karin. The rural village was just beginning to stir. The rangers could hear chickens clucking, the cheerful natter of Filipinas busily cooking breakfast over wood stoves. A few scabby gamecocks pecked in the dirt, strutting the tight orbits of their chains. As with every village they'd passed near, the Balin Karin dogs marched out to the edge of town to snarl at the rangers, sending up an unholy racket.
"Will somebody shut up those mutts?" Musi yelled.
Balin Karin was 5 miles north of the POW camp, too close to the enemy for the rangers' taste.
"From here on," Musi said, "we gotta get the locals to muzzle every last dog in the area. The Japs'll know something's up."
Soon the townsfolk emerged from their nipa shacks to hush the dogs. The people gathered around the rangers, offering ripe papayas and the partially incubated duck eggs known as balut. Bare-breasted women, some of them nursing children, came up without a hint of shyness and mingled with the men. They smiled at the tall Americans, studying their unfamiliar uniforms and their strange-looking guns, saying,
"Magandang umaga, salamat!"
Long live America. Just a few weeks before, Balin Karin had suffered a bloody reprisal from the Japanese army, apparently because the barrio had been harboring guerrillas. A group of soldiers from the Japanese garrison in Cabanatuan City had stormed in with tanks and shot up the place, killing a substantial number of guerrillas and a few civilians as well. The people in Balin Karin were uncomfortable talking about it, and it was unclear precisely how many had been murdered. Musi later reported in an article in the Saturday Evening Post that as many as 100 people were killed in the vicinity, though other accounts put the number closer to 20. When the subject came up, the villagers responded by smiling awkwardly and shaking their heads. All the rangers were able to learn was that something horrible had recently happened here. The people of Balin Karin were still obviously haunted by the tragedy, and not so quietly nursing revenge. Maybe this explained why they were so happy to see the rangers. They'd been around Yanks before, of course, but these were a different breed from 3 years ago. Bigger, it seemed, better armed, more confident, with a curious squash-yellow glow to their skin, the result of their daily intake of the new anti-malarial Atibrin. Over the past few weeks, the Filipinos had watched American planes vectoring overhead, and they'd heard the welcome wrath of American artillery. Yet this was their first look at flesh-and-blood American troops since the days of Bataan. The Emperor's army was on the run now, and the people in Balin Karin could sense by the swagger of these new Americans that it was only a matter of time. If the villagers were excited to see Musi's men, no one was the least bit surprised by their presence. The barrio already seemed to be well aware of the rangers' mission. It was as though John the Baptist had passed through town several days earlier to herald their imminent arrival. Children, grandmothers, even the dogs appeared to know what was afoot. Musi was astonished and not a little miffed by this development.
"So I guess the cat's out of the bag," he snapped.
The last thing a ranger on assignment ever wanted was for his reputation to precede him. That this top-secret mission was now common knowledge seemed to mock all their assiduous efforts at stealth. Musi and Prince could only cross their fingers and pray the virus of common knowledge didn't spread to Japanese ears. More than ever, they had to trust in the rock-bed loyalty of the local people. During the early days of the occupation, the Nueva Ecija countryside had certainly known its share of Makapili, Japanese sympathizers. But now, with the tide so obviously turning in America's favor, the danger of collaborators seemed less likely.
"I wasn't worried about informants," Prince later said. "I figured a Quisling would have been pretty stupid by this point in the war. They knew we'd taken Leyte. They knew we were taking Luzon. They could see the writing on the wall."
It wasn't necessarily a question of informants, though. A breach might just as easily occur by accident.
If a Japanese spy happened to be purposefully loitering around the rice granaries or the village market, one incautious remark among friends could precipitate disaster. Musi figured that if the Japanese got wind of the raid, by whatever means, they'd respond in one of two ways. Either their troops would try to ambush his men, or, just as likely, the Japanese army would simply hasten the timetable for a massacre at the camp, so that by the time the Rangers got there, the enemy would be long gone, and the feared slaughter would have already been accomplished. The colonel had intended to keep marching another 40 minutes to the village of Platero, the last barrio before Cabanatuan camp, but he could see his men needed a good rest, as did he. They would sit out the morning here. Footsore and frazzled, the Rangers lay down in the shadow of two decrepit school buses to unburden themselves of their loads and massage their calves. They'd been up 24 hours, marching some 25 miles from the drop-off point at Gimba. From Balankarin, the POW camp was only about an hour's march south. They were within striking distance. The assault would begin at dusk. The flush of approaching combat was canceling, or at least masking, their physical fatigue. Sleep was what they needed most, even just a good catnap. But sleep seemed unthinkable now that battle jitters were taking hold. The gathering excitement, the thrum in the gut, the taste of metal on the tongue. Locals generously filled the ranger canteens with artesian water and offered rice balls wrapped in waxy banana leaves. The rangers bolted their breakfasts and talked high-spiritedly of the raid, wondering aloud what Musi and Prince had planned for them. A fierce sun had climbed over the Sierra Madre, sending early warning of another hot day on the central plain. By 8 o'clock, the air was already torpid. The tropical sunlight bore down on them, a penetrating glare that seemed to have weight. Out in the fields, the glistening gray hulks of carabaos were hunched low in their wallows, creeping along through the muck. In the shadows cast by the old school buses, Captain Prince removed his boots and inspected his feet. It was worse than he feared. The jungle rot had left the skin on his ankles and feet as fragile as onion skin, and now they were raw with a half dozen blisters. Medallions of blood seeped through his socks. The blisters had smarted so intensely during the last few miles of the hike that he winced with every step. Prince wondered what he'd do if his blister problem got much worse. It was a potentially embarrassing situation for a company commander, to be this badly bunged up with something so banal as foot trouble. So Prince didn't breathe a word about it to Musi or anyone else. He figured he could certainly make it to the POW camp, as close as it was. The long marathon back to American lines, however, was iffier. By then, he wondered whether he'd be just another gimp, as lame as the POWs he was supposed to be leading to safety. Gingerly, he slipped his socks and boots back on, keeping his secret to himself. Prince broke out his map and began to sketch his ideas for the raid. With his M1 lying in the grass beside him, he arranged a series of aerial photos of Cabanatuan that had been taken from a Piper Cub reconnaissance plane. Alternately tugging at his chin and swatting mosquitoes, he squinted to read the map's fine points in the broadening daylight. Beads of sweat rose on his forehead, occasionally spattering his notes. No matter what else happens, he kept saying to himself, the crux of the enterprise, the linchpin, was absolute surprise. The significance couldn't be overstated. If we have it, Prince thought, then anything is possible. As he cross-checked the aerial photos against the map, however, one thing struck him loud and clear. The countryside surrounding the camp was as flat and expansive as Nebraska prairie. There appeared to be no trees or structures to hide behind, just a monochrome plate of grass. By the look of things, it would be a long, tense crawl, hundreds and hundreds of yards, perhaps, before they reached the gate. They'd be exposed for the entire approach, like worms twisting on a sidewalk after a summer storm. For the young captain, the anxiety was mounting. The master plan Musi had asked Prince to devise was supposed to cover every contingency, from the moment the first shot was fired to the moment the last prisoners stumbled out the front gate. Musi would be in charge of getting them all to the edge of the compound, but Prince would take it from there. As the assault commander, he would oversee everything. With the help of his platoon leaders, he had to figure out how to apportion the manpower and the firepower, how to choreograph the event so that bullets flew in the right direction at the right time, as hundreds of men ran this way and that through smoky darkness. While Musi would be somewhere in the outlying grasslands watching the carefully designed fracas unfold through binoculars, Prince would be where the action was, having to make the split-second judgment calls. It was Musi's show in the end, but the main act, the incursion itself, was Prince's special predicament to solve or bungle. "I was very apprehensive," Prince later recalled. "Any commander's greatest fear is the fear of failure. It preys on you. You have to keep your focus. You have to consider all the things that could go wrong, but then you have to quickly banish them from your mind. If you think about them too long, you can't go forward. You're paralyzed." Prince considered it an honor that Musi placed so much faith in him, yet the pressure was immense, especially for someone so young. Captain Prince was 24, just a few years out of Stanford, where he'd studied economics and history and served as his fraternity's president. But he looked even younger than he was. Prince carried himself with a certain awkward youthfulness, as though he were still growing into his body. One ranger remembered him as fresh. He'd never seen combat before, not up close. 48 hours ago, Prince had never heard of Cabanatuan. Now he was charged with liberating the place. The window was uncomfortably tight. Just a few hours remained for Prince and Musi to work out the details. As high as the stakes were, there was little in their training that had specifically prepared the men for this sort of endeavor. The rangers were flying blind. "We couldn't rehearse this," Prince said. "Anything of this nature, you'd ordinarily want to practice it over and over for weeks in advance. Get more information, build models, and discuss all the contingencies, work out all the kinks. We didn't have time for any of that. It was now or not." Musi thought the world of his C Company commander. "My wonderful Captain Prince," he called him. Prince, for his part, was mildly embarrassed by the colonel's attentions. "I don't know what he saw in me, really," Prince said. "But he liked me, and I liked him. It was a personal thing. For some reason, he trusted me." Prince had grown up in a middle-class Seattle family, and had attended a high school where many of his classmates were Japanese Americans. He'd spent his summers working in apple orchards, pruning trees, picking and sorting fruits according to the industry's curiously termed standards, extra fancy, well-formed, or grossly misshapen. In some ways, Prince seemed the direct opposite of the colonel. He wasn't gung-ho, he wasn't charismatic, he wasn't theatrical. He didn't radiate the conspicuous verve of a war hero. He had none of Musi's athletic grace or strutting physicality. Prince was gangling of build, and his body language, cautious, tentative, failed to telegraph a martial sensibility. "If you were looking at him," recalled fellow ranger Vance Shears, "you wouldn't even think he was a soldier." Most rangers liked and greatly respected Prince, even if they didn't love him with the same abandon they reserved for Musi. They saw that in choosing the young captain to lead the assault, Musi had made precisely the right call. In contrast to the mercurial colonel, Prince's assessments of things were always moderated, neither inflated with his own opinions nor lacquered with extraneous concerns. The young captain provided the sober ballast necessary to offset Musi's fiery allure. As one ranger later put it, if Musi was the heart and soul of the operation, Prince was the brains. "He had a great mind and great composure," recalled Ranger Robert Anderson. "I never saw him irritated by anything. His name wasn't far off the mark. He was a prince of a fellow." More than anything else, what Musi and Prince needed was hard information, the specs of the camp, accurate reports on the whereabouts and strength of the enemy, the precise location of every pillbox and guard tower on the premises, recommendations on the best routes of ingress and egress. They needed to know the size and style of the padlock on the front gate. They had to ascertain where every fence was, how tall, and composed of how many strands of barbed wire. Were there drainage ditches, ravines, or other features that could provide cover? Exactly how many Americans were in there, and which barracks were they staying in? how many of them could walk and how many would require litters. Where were the power generators, the radios, the telephone and telegraph lines? On and on the list went. In the most copiously detailed sense, the Rangers had to understand what they were up against. The vital information they needed, or at least the promise of it, came at last in the form of Bill Nellist and Tom Rounceval, two dusty, sweat-streaked, sun-scorched Alamo scouts. The Alamo scouts were a legendary unit of behind-the-lines intelligence gatherers that had been personally created by General Kruger earlier in the war. The scouts had already racked up an incredible string of successful exploits elsewhere in the Pacific, without losing a single man, including the flawless rescue of 66 Dutch POWs in the jungles of New Guinea. General Kruger and Horton White had dispatched 2 5-man squads of the scouts ahead of the Rangers to undertake a thorough reconnaissance of the camp and to prepare an intelligence report for Musi. Nellist and Rounceval were the 2 squad leaders. Thrilled to see fresh American faces after 2 long days, the 2 men rushed to greet Musi and Prince with exhausted smiles. However, they had bad news. The scouts were nowhere close to getting the goods. The recon report Musi and Prince so urgently needed was still a work in progress. The scouts had been working around the clock, carefully studying the perimeter of the camp. They'd made all kinds of preliminary sketches, and they'd mapped out the likeliest escape routes across the Pampanga River. But the most salient pieces of information, such as how many tanks were parked outside, how many Japanese troops were there, and precisely where they were quartered, still remained question marks. They didn't even have a definitive layout of the camp. "We can't get up close," Nellist explained. "It's flat as a pancake out there." What little information the Alamo scouts were able to glean was dismaying, to say the least. Day and night, the camp environs had been a nest of Imperial Army activity. The north-south road that ran directly in front of the main gate had seen a nearly uninterrupted flow of traffic, tanks, armored vehicles, transport trucks. "It looks like Main Street in Tokyo," Rounceval said. "The place is thick with Japs." It was a confusing mishmash of movement. While some of the enemy vehicles appeared to be retreating to the north, others were hastening south to fortify the garrison at Cabanatuan City, where the Japanese were evidently preparing to take a stand against the advancing 6th Army. Guerrilla reports indicated that as many as 7,000 Japanese troops were now assembled in Cabanatuan City. "And that's just over 3 miles southwest of the camp, right along the road here," Nellist reminded the colonel as they hovered over Musi's topo map.
7,000?
Musi repeated the figure with obvious dismay spreading over his face. To the northeast, Nellist and Rounceval explained, there loomed an even more immediate threat. Approximately 200 Japanese soldiers were camped in a bamboo grove along the banks of the Kabu River. Their bivouac site was a mere mile away from the POW camp, easily within earshot of any shooting that would ensue during the night's sortie. They were elite Imperial Army troops, the Dokuho 359 Battalion, under the command of Tomeo Oyabu, and they were well equipped with tanks and armored vehicles. Hearing this evening's fireworks, all they'd have to do was cross a wooden bridge spanning the Kabu River and speed a few hundred yards down the main road to the camp. It would be a bloodbath. The final piece of the puzzle was the most crucial, and it was the piece the Alamo scouts lacked. What exactly was the situation inside the enclosure? The scouts had learned a few spotty details from guerrillas, who nonchalantly snooped along the fence in civilian clothes, posing as farmers. There appeared to be about 70 armed guards staying inside the camp, and it was obvious that substantial numbers of transient Japanese troops were also sleeping there. How many was unclear, and the number fluctuated every night, but their best guess was around 100. At last count, 4 tanks had been seen entering the compound, as well as an assortment of other heavy vehicles, yet nobody was sure where they were housed. This paucity of intelligence infuriated the colonel. He paced and brooded and fidgeted with his pipe. The raid was in peril. "We have to know more," he shouted, "a lot more." He stripped off his sunglasses to reveal bloodshot eyes, seething with exasperated alarm. "We can get it, sir," Lieutenant Nellist replied confidently. "We need more time." "Don't have time," Musi said, his jaw clenched. When it came to intelligence gathering, the Alamo scouts were supposed to be the elite of the elite. Kruger's darlings, his eyes and ears. But so far, Musi was unimpressed.
Look, he said, I don't care how you do it, just go back there and get the goods.
Feeling chastened, Nellist and Rouncival arrowed back to Platero to redouble their efforts. Colonel Musi, Captain Prince, and Captain Hosun were gathered in a grove of trees with several non-coms, discussing various imponderables of the raid, when their confab was interrupted.
Colonel Musi?
A Filipino man called out in a soft voice. The rangers wheeled about to behold a gorilla riding bareback on a tiny horse. His shoulders were crisscrossed with bandoliers of ammo, and he seemed perfectly at ease with the M1 carbine that was strapped over his shoulder. He was small-statured and unprepossessing, yet something about his presence, an air of steely competence, of quiet menace, made him vaguely intimidating.
Captain Juan Pajota, he said, with a crisp salute.
Behind him was a force of several dozen gorillas.
Captain, Musi said, brightening just a little, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Like his compatriot Eduardo Hosun, Juan Pajota was a well-known Filipino guerrilla leader who had so tenaciously devoted himself to the resistance that the Japanese had long ago put a price out on his head. Captain Pajota knew every inch of this neck of Nueva Ecija, knew it not only as an itinerant soldier and insurrectionary, but as someone who had grown up here. His headquarters was over in Cabu, which lay just a few miles to the northeast of Cabanatuan City. His territory included Balincarin, Platero, and all the surrounding lands. The Cabanatuan POW camp was squarely in his backyard. Pajota dismounted from his pony and shook hands with Musi, Prince, and Hosun. All told, Pajota could commit a guerrilla force of about 90 armed soldiers and another 160 unarmed men to help with logistics and aiding the prisoners. Most of Pajota's men were either in Platero or scattered about elsewhere in the region, awaiting his word. Soon the rangers fell back into a tense discussion of the raid, and Pajota was asked to contribute his thoughts on the matter.
When do you intend to carry out the attack? Pajota inquired.
Musi and Prince were a little confused by the question.
Tonight at dusk, Musi responded. That's always been the plan.
After a long, awkward silence, Pajota said,
Sir, with all due respect, that is suicide.
Musi was taken aback by Pajota's seeming effrontery. A little captain from the hinterlands questioning the soundness of a plan officially conceived and endorsed by the high command of the U.S. Sixth Army? Pajota quickly assured Musi that it was the timing, not the plan itself, that was fatally flawed.
I'm sure you must know the enemy's situation, Pajota said,
and then proceeded to lay out nearly the same details that Nellist and Rouncival had described earlier, except that Pajota now supplied three disturbing new wrinkles. During the early morning hours, he said, the force of 200 Japanese soldiers camping on the banks of the nearby Kabu River had swelled to more than 1,000. Instead of only 100 Japanese troops bivouacking inside the camp, new intelligence reports were indicating three times that number. Finally, Filipino spies in Cabanatuan City had received word that another large convoy of troops and heavy equipment would be pulling out early this evening and heading north toward Bungabon. If this report was correct, then tonight at dusk, when the raid was set to commence, the road directly in front of the camp's main gate would be thoroughly congested with Japanese traffic. Thinking it manifest madness to undertake a prison bust in the midst of an enemy exodus, Pajota said calmly, I think you should wait 24 hours. Musi and Prince studied each other and drank in the significance of everything Pajota had reported.
That, replied Musi stubbornly, is the decision I will make once we reach Platero and receive the latest report from the Alamo scouts.
Although Musi was putting a bluff and resolute face on things, clearly Pajota's new details had rattled the colonel, and the case for postponement was persuasive. What made Pajota so compelling was his obviously intimate knowledge of the terrain. He knew all the mayors of all the barrios. He was familiar with the realities on the ground,
every quirk of the Carabao paths, every river bend. Whatever men or arms might need to be mustered, Pajota had the political wherewithal to make it happen. Pajota was a stern-looking man of 30 years. He wore an old khaki uniform of the U.S. Army Forces of the Far East, with a .45-caliber automatic pistol at his side. He had a round, high, cheekbone face and a penetrating stare. His voice was grave, his English clipped and richly accented, but quite fluent. Robert Laffam, the American guerrilla leader, recalled that Pajota was quiet and sincere, but had a tough streak in him. He was a very unflamboyant guy, with a natural bent for leadership. He was resourceful, organized, and extremely imaginative. He was from Nueva Ecija, and knew it like a book. As the day wore on, Musi, Prince, Hosan, and Pajota remained huddled in Balinkarin with their crimped and annotated maps sprawled in the grass. For hours and hours, they sat discussing every conceivable angle of the raid. The conversation turned to the worrisome matter of transportation. What would they do with all the prisoners who couldn't walk? It was a problem Musi had been stewing over ever since they left Gimba. Springing them was one thing. Ferrying them those 30 miles back to American lines was something else again. Pajota explained that the Cabanatuan camp was now essentially a hospital. Over the past few months, the Japanese had been systematically culling the able-bodied prisoners and shipping them to Japan. The Imperial Army had left behind the sickest and weakest of the lot. There were just over 500 remaining, most of them rife with disease, immobile or semi-mobile. "But I think I have an answer to that problem," Pajota offered, fetching immediate reactions. "Yes," Musi said. "Carabao." The colonel was a little confused. "Carabao? Water buffalo?" Pajota nodded enthusiastically. "I can send the word out to the barrios. We can have Carabao carts waiting at the Pampanga River. Now that the rice harvest is over, the animals aren't being used. Each cart can carry about 5 or 6 prisoners." The idea seemed laughable at first. The Carabao, a notoriously sluggish beast of burden, was capable of galloping at a fleet 2 miles per hour. Maybe, if ridden by a sinewy Filipino boy swatting the poor harumphing behemoth with a green stalk of sugarcane. The beasts would be dragging rickety wooden carts with massive knotted wheels the size of dinner tables, their creaking wagon beds lined with rice straw. Pajota's plan seemed ludicrously low-tech. It was medieval transportation, glaringly out of step with the demands of a mechanized modern army. Yet the more Musi thought about the idea, the more it struck him as irresistible. Moving at Carabao speed, the return to the American lines would be a long, slow, deliberate plod, like a wilderness wandering in the Bible. The evacuation might look a little peculiar, but as long as the Filipinos could keep the beasts moving, the glacial cavalcade would eventually make it to safety. It was settled. A hegira by buffalo cart. Pajota would get the word out around Platero and the neighboring barrios, and have the carabaos, wagons, and drivers at the ready. They'd be waiting en masse at the banks of the Pampanga River at 8 o'clock that night. A little after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the rangers packed up their belongings and marched out of Balinkarin, heading straight for Platero, which lay a little more than 2 miles to the south. As they walked, Hosan's guerrillas flanked the right side, Pajota's guerrillas flanked the left. Now they were a force of some 300 armed men fanning out over the rice fields. Despite Pajota's well-lodged caveats, everything remained set to begin at sunset that night, about 3.5 hours hence. Prince asked Pajota whether the dogs in Platero could be tied up and muzzled to keep the racket down. Pajota sent his messengers ahead to remedy the situation. On the outskirts of Platero, several Alamo scouts were waiting for Musi with bad news. Just as Pajota had warned, a large contingent of Japanese troops was pulling out of Cabanatuan City. Now hundreds, possibly thousands, of Imperial Army soldiers were marching northeast on Highway 5, heading directly for the prison camp. Hearing that, Musi made his decision instantly. Pajota was right. Continuing on would be suicidal, a head-on collision. There was no way around it. The attack had to be delayed. As Musi later told the New York Times, there was nothing we could do against that force.
Musi ordered his communications man to call in the news to 6th Army headquarters. The Rangers were supposed to break radio silence only in the most exigent circumstances, but these circumstances certainly qualified. The radio operator transmitted the encoded message. New developments. 24-hour delay. After a few long minutes, the radio man got the truncated reply. Message acknowledged. And the men stumbled toward Platero, immensely relieved by their late-breaking extension.